got it. All right, here we go. Tom and Curley Show. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in on a Monday. Lots of news to get to. Write to us. Text as well. 1-888-973-5476. Lots to talk about. Whoa, that's cold. Colin Powell, Tom, passes away. Yep. At the age of 84.
84. I didn't realize he was as old as that. He was very, you know, fit. I mean, he looked very...
well, he's a military guy, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I hadn't seen him on television in a long time. And he was involved in various other projects recently after leaving public office and sort of the public place. And he developed... He was diagnosed with a type of cancer, I think... back in 2018.
Myeloma.
Or something. Yeah, myeloma, and it weakened his immune system. He had been vaccinated, but when you get a bad immune system, there's not much you can do even with a vaccine. So he succumbs to that, and now, of course, you hear from everybody talking about Colin Powell and what he did. Here is Kamala Harris. I believe she's still the vice president.
You know, he is the first black person, black man to be Joint Chiefs, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, to be National Security Advisor, to be Secretary of State. Every step of the way, when he filled those roles, he was, by everything that he did and the way he did it, inspiring so many people. And there's been a lot of conversation about that, how young service members and others, not only in the military, but in our nation and around the globe, took notice of what his accomplishments meant as a reflection of who we are as a nation. And I think that's one of the most important things to take away, which is that he broke so many barriers, and those barriers were not easy to break by any stretch. But he did it with dignity. He did it with grace. And because of what he was able to accomplish, it really did elevate our nation in so many ways. So may he rest in peace.
Okay, well, you hear about defense, you hear about Austin or Chris Wallace talking about it or anything else?
The interesting thing for Lloyd Austin is that he now is an African-American sort of in his footstep, in Colin Powell's footsteps. I don't know what he said. I don't know if there's anything surprising about it, but clearly he was a trailblazer for people like Lloyd Austin.
Mm-hmm. Did Colin Powell get the job because he's black?
Well, I mean, I guess that's the question that you have. I don't think I haven't heard anybody else asking that question. He started, you know, early on, and he was impressive at each step of the way. He was he served in Vietnam in 1962. I mean, that was before Vietnam was even a much of a controversy. So, I mean, he's been around in a long time. I don't have any inside information.
He received, by the way, 3 votes for president in 2016 from the great state of Washington.
Is that right? Well, I know, you know, both parties.
Three of the unfaithful said, go, we want him. They say he would have beaten, when he made the decision not to run against Bill Clinton. They said that in the White House at the time when he went on television, they were smiles and cheers because a poll had him winning by, I think, 14. And then the day of the election, they did another poll and he would have beaten Clinton by like 20 or 30. If there's a great, interesting piece in the National Review, take a look at it. You'd like it, Tom. If he had run, how it would have changed the country. So it's just for the domino effect. If he would have won, he's pro-abortion. So then it might have split the party. Then Pat Buchanan might have actually won because he pulled votes away from Republicans and from Clinton. You could have a third party, or he could have run as a third party. There would have been no George Bush. There would have been, and there might have been more control over our defense. There might have been no 9/11. There would have been no Donald Trump as the last thing. There would have been no Barack Obama. He walked through all of it to go through the whole thing to say how he would have changed America if he had decided. Now, of course, that's all all hypothetical, if he had decided to run against Bill Clinton when, and then even in 2000, they asked him again, you want to run? You want? He's just, I don't have the taste for politics. So,
but what the interesting thing is, so yeah, both parties. So he was, as for the longest time, he declared himself an independent when he was in the military. Mm-hmm. He then declared himself after he left the military that he was a Republican. And then in the last couple of elections, he endorsed Barack Obama. And then his emails revealed that he couldn't stand Donald Trump. So he became more of like a Democrat, even though I don't think he ever changed his party affiliation. The amazing thing about him, and again, I completely understand this because he was always on the sidelines. Both Republicans and Democrats tried to lure him to their side as a possible candidate. And he, the one thing I wasn't sure of, except until I was reading this, he took that possibility very seriously. He seriously considered running for president, and then he decided not to. And I think he's smart not to. You always look better when you're on the sidelines.
Oh,
once you get into the fray, you're muddied up with everybody else. And I don't think that he would have the standing that he did or does if he had gotten into it, because his personality, I know you were kind of smirking, I think, when you heard Kamala Harris talk about, but you know, his dignity and grace are not the kinds of things that usually win elections. And he'd have to kind of change and become a little more pugnacious, I think, to actually, to run. So I don't know where you stand on Colin Powell. In general, to me, and he admitted this, and he wrote this autobiography about, he thinks he had one blot on his career, and that's when he went before the United Nations and
used
this evidence that turned out to be bogus about the fact that that Saddam Hussein actually had nuclear weapons and all of this stuff, and he was embarrassed by that. But for me, as a good Democrat, John, I like the fact that he glommed on to Barack Obama's campaign, and he had a distaste for Trump. Since those aren't your politics, do you have a kind of a sour taste in your mouth when it comes to?
No, I always liked him. I read his book, and I remember reading a really incredible piece when he was going through. And I only know this because I used to live there in Woodbridge, Virginia, and he stopped to use the gas station. It was like 1978 or something, and the guy wouldn't let him use the gas station. Wouldn't let him use the bathroom.
He's black.
I was like, wow, in Virginia, Northern Virginia. I always liked the guy. I don't know if he was really into Obama. I know that he certainly he had a great distaste for Donald Trump. And he said, I've left the Republican Party after Trump got in there. But God love him. He served the country and did well for himself and his family. And you're right, Tom. Listen, when you wrestle pigs, both you and the pigs get muddy. I mean, nobody comes into politics and runs for president and still maintains to be graceful with dignity. That doesn't exist. And we've only elected a couple of generals like that, right? We've had Eisenhower.
Eisenhower. Ulysses S. Grant, who was apparently
George Washington.
Terrible. George Washington.
Yep.
Andrew Jackson.
Yes. So I don't know where we would be if we had Colin Powell, but it's a really interesting piece in the National Review looking ahead. Let's say the Pike Place Market is and its vendors in COVID, and the lockdown has continued to cripple Pike Place Market. And I saw that Seattle had the greatest drop off in tourism. We led the country in the decline of tourists coming here in 2000. It's slowly starting to crawl back up again.
Yeah,
but still, cities that are in the hotel business that is in depression, and recession. In depression, there are 8 of them, and Seattle, San Francisco, Chicago, Washington D.C., and New York are all in a depression. The others in a recession. So, still haven't gotten back up to 2019 numbers. But this piece in the Seattle Times takes a look at how difficult it is for vendors to continue to make a living there at Pike Place Market. It would seem to me because a lot of the business that goes in there and buys stuff are tourists that are coming in and spending time. Of course, you go to Pike Place Market. So how many locals are going down there? I can't imagine that many.
All the cruise ship activity, which, was done for 18 months. That was, I don't know if it was the lifeblood of the market, but it was certainly the profit lifeblood of the market. It was interesting, just like we've said on practically every industry, the pandemic accelerated problems or trends that were there before the pandemic. For instance, they were mentioning that one of the issues about Pike Place Market is, I mean, when I was growing up, Pike Place Market was like the only place where you could go get kind of fresh produce like that. Now, with so many farmers markets in just about every little neighborhood around Seattle, that's no longer the draw. There has to be other things to draw you down. The Seattle Times does a really nice job of kind of profiling. So who's back and who isn't? They start off with a guy who's selling flowers, and he says, and business actually has been pretty darn good for him. Why is that? Because the other four flower vendors didn't come back.
Yeah.
And so he says, so personally, it works out for me. The question, though, is if there are so few vendors left, and we'll have to see how many eventually come back. But with few vendors, the vendors that are there are doing pretty good business. But ultimately, it might not be a big enough attraction to bring people there at all. And maybe the few that are now buying all of his flowers may stop coming. I'm assuming they assume a bounce back, but they do say that it has kind of culled the field a lot. Uh-huh. And until the economy is back booming, they really wonder about Pike Place Market, how well it will survive. It might have to survive on kind of a lower level basis than it has in the past, and it's already been tough on them anyway.
Yeah,
the
vendor that normally throws the fish, they said, he says, I don't do that anymore. I don't do a show. It's just me by myself. I don't have people coming in buying $500 worth of fish. They're buying oysters, this and that, and clams, but they're not buying the big setup. So he doesn't even bother doing the big setup. If you don't have the tourists coming in, the conventions that Seattle really relies upon, if you don't have those people, because you could see them, they're all kind of coming through, eyes all ogly, and they look at a few, maybe they pick up a few souvenirs. That seemed to be the lifeblood of Pike Place Market. Well, they're not coming in town, or if they do come in town, I don't know how safe they necessarily feel. I looked up last night, how safe is it to be in Seattle? And it was backpackers.com. So it was like, you're going through, it's a cool city, this and that, but certainly do watch yourself. There are certain sections of the city that I wouldn't go into at night. The guy was giving advice. So I don't know. Do you think you want to go down to Pike Place Market in the dark in that area? That's a really nasty area now at night. And I don't think you necessarily want to go over there and
the
risk your life.
The market tends not to be open, though, at the late hours. I mean, they close around dinner time, so I'm not, at least in this analysis by the Seattle Times, no one mentions safety is an issue or a concern. Now it might be a concern if you have a restaurant down there, what kind of traffic you get after dark. But for them, one of the other interesting things about the article, John, is they talk about how people have adapted. They mentioned this this one restaurant, Soundview Cafe, and they decide to re-engineering their menu, that they got rid of a lot of these complicated high-end items. So now they have a more cost-efficient menu. They take the six or seven things that are their biggest sellers or their biggest profit generators, and they just focus on that. So there's been a lot of kind of a, I don't know if it's a reducing the business, but kind of like making for a more efficient business model in a lot of their range. Just like a lot of the places, the vendors that sell vegetables, they are also farming their stuff out to the neighborhood farming markets, so they're not entirely dependent on a Pike Place Market, and that could change it forever.
And the same thing is happening apparently in the used car market, according to the Wall Street Journal. Selling cars,
yes,
selling
true.
Used cars in the era of chip shortage. Online chats and no more haggling, that there are people that have gotten out of the used car business. Those that are in it stay in it, and there's not as much competition, and they're still doing quite well. And also, there's a limited supply. So you come in, you really don't have as much bargaining power as you had before. So now the world of selling used cars,
And new cars
as well. So there's not as many dealers, there's not as many salesmen. So people are doing better in that business.
And, John, the interesting thing is they don't even necessarily come in.
No.
More and more, 75% of business now done online. And so what they do finally do, and they can even deliver your car if that you want to, but they say that a lot of the times now, all they do is they come in to finalize the sale and then pick up the car right then. That's how it's arranged. And I was thinking about you, although you have many other opportunities, but you have the perfect personality for a car salesman. You've got charisma, self-confidence.
I could never do that. No.
Really?
And
it says it helps have a big personality. You know, what do you mean? If you can sell medical equipment, for Pete's sake,
that people
can certainly sell a car.
People need bedpans.
Oh, so you're only pushing something you believe in? How
no,
unlike
not that I
you,
believe
John.
In it. It's just much easier to sell something that, listen, I could beat somebody on price or sell bedpans, cotton balls, needles, and syringes. That's easy. And the guy's coming in for the car. You know, you see what they drive in so that you can then say, I'll offer you X for your trade-in. There's so many little maneuvers that they're doing to get you in the car and then upgrade you in this and then that and that. They take you in the other room and they basically, you know, grind you down. You know, talk to your sales. Then you're talking to the bank guy. Then like five hours later, you're just like so tired. You're like, whatever. Oh, I want to get insurance. All the little odds and ends in order to make an additional $400 or $500. Yeah. I can't stand that.
You're not a detailed man.
No. It's not the detail. And I don't want to fight somebody. Some guy comes in. Yeah, I saw the invoice. Listen, I didn't have to do that kind of fighting stuff. Selling medical supplies. Someone has to go tinky. They need a place to tinky. That used to say that on the side of our trucks.
It.
And I was selling a Bemis. Well, you know the Bemis building down there in Seattle?
Yeah.
B-E-M-I-S.
Okay.
Bemis bedpans.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And
I think
now
that's where
you
that
know
came from.
The rest of the story. By the way, though, John, all those factors that I thought would make you a great salesman, they're saying they're becoming irrelevant. Today, the roles, they're looking for tech-savvy people with analytic skills for being able to use the computer to figure out what this person really needs and all this. So all those kind of big personalities that are caricatured on, you know, in movies and TV shows about what a car salesman's really like, now they're becoming, you know, nerdier, I guess. They're more analytical and tech-savvy. So that would also rule you out. And
my
me.
Friend Michael Whalen could never, didn't sell one car. He worked for 3 months. Somebody lady came in and she, I want to get this, I'm going to get that. And he goes, you know what you need? You know what you need? You don't need this car. You know what you need to do? You need to go home and think about how great your life is. Is this your daughter? She's like, yeah, beautiful daughter. You need to go home. You don't need a car. You know what you need to do? You need some time alone just to look at how great your life is. And the woman's like, can I get somebody to sell me a car? She goes, you're the weirdest sales technique. He goes, no, I'm just telling you. You don't need this. You don't need this car. Oh, my God. He was horrible.
He should put his shingle up and become a therapist.
That's what he could have done. All right. Tracy Taylor's looking at traffic for Russell on a Monday. Here we go. Kia Mortgage 1-888-778. K, by the way, that's Sean playing the organ. K-I-E-L. I should mention that. Like when you go to a hockey game and the guy's got the organ up there and they point to him, get the fans going.
He's our Paul Schaefer.
That's what he is.
That's right.
1-888-770-K-I-E-L. Let's listen to Sean a little bit more. Here we go.
Yeah. You feel that?
I do. I like the way you roll your head back and forth.
Yes.
All righty. It was 1965 when Laurence Olivier put on the blackface to play the Othello, the king. And they shot that movie. And then that was he's always been an amazing actor. But apparently the reviews on him that he was sort of, you know, like doing the rolling his eyes around and sort of doing the kind of classic, I don't know, minstrel show features. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Othello was like that. I actually saw Christopher, what's his name? Oh my gosh, I can't remember his name. Dodd. He was on Sound of Music. Christopher, come on, Tom.
Plummer.
Thank you. I saw him on Broadway do it with James Earl Jones. James Earl Jones played the black guy. Plummer played Iago, and that was life there on the stage. This was a movie made. Well, what happened was they made the movie, and then this professor. When did this happen? Back in 1965? Oh, no, just a couple of months ago. Here's a little bit from Laurence Olivier.
By the word, I think my wife be honest and think she is not. I think thou art just and think thou art not. I have some proof. My name, which was as fresh as Dian's visage, is now begrimed and black as mine own face.
She'd never cheat on him, Tom.
If there be cords or knives, poison or fire or suffocating screams, I'm not enduring. Would I well satisfy?
A little high squeaky voice. Othello is sort of a big guy. Anyway, that's what I remember from James Earl Jones' performance of it. It's one of Shakespeare's classics. Iago is always the sinister guy. It's just a great play. This professor from who came from China and was teaching at University of Michigan and very well liked guy, apparently up for a Pulitzer and well established in his career. He shows the students and he wants to show them the movie because I think he's trying to use the music and he's trying to show how the music is incorporated into Shakespeare. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, he wants to show them how to take a classic literary text.
Yeah,
with Shakespeare's play, and how you can turn that into an opera, because Verdi based his opera, Otello, on Shakespeare's Othello. So he was showing this as kind of a, you know, sort of how do you take a classic work of art and this, and the most readily available, I assume, to him, or maybe the best known version of Othello was the movie version.
Yes.
And that got him into a lot of trouble. A
lot of trouble. So a couple of students complained, and then they brought him up. He apologized. That wasn't enough. Then he had to apologize more. He wrote a letter. Then he said, this letter is even more insulting because you're saying, look at all the other minority students that you've cast in your plays. This is just, you don't get it. You don't get it. And then he goes to the dean, and the dean sort of says, well, we've decided, the two of us, this is can't be true, that he's going to just sort of stop teaching that class or stop teaching for a while. What do they want to do? Is he just
he's continuing to instruct individual students, you know, so he's continuing his employment there. But he decided because of all the controversy from that one particular class that he was stepping away from that class.
I don't think he decided that. I think they decided that for him. But, you know, we don't know that for sure. I would just assume any right. university that spends $85 million a year on diversity employees, they have more than 90 employees that they have who's in charge of making sure this type of ideology has a place for the students. This is also the university where the kids complain and said, we want to have our own black student union. We want to spend $10 million on it. We don't want white people to come to it. So this is the university hotbed for this sort of stuff. So this guy who came from communist China, whose piano was destroyed by the communist, whose parents were run out, now comes to the United States, established himself as a great teacher, professor. He apparently didn't warn enough kids that there may be a white guy in blackface, and it was too upsetting for the students, right?
Yes. Well, I think so. The criticism, what he has apologized for, and I think this makes some sense. He's apologized for not kind of contextualizing what they were about to see. Mm. So the problem with this, the play has always been problematic. In fact, there are a lot of Shakespeare plays that are problematic. I remember during the height of the feminist movement, doing Taming of the Shrew was a very tricky matter because it's how the woman seems to be, you know, it, as the title says, the woman is the shrew and it takes a strong man to tame the shrew. Uh-huh. And so it really it can be played as a very sexist kind of play. You also have the problem of Shylock in Merchant of Venice,
right,
who the villain, and he's also Jewish. And so the question is, are we villainizing Jewish, you know, or Jews in that way? And in this particular case, because it's such an exaggerated version of being black, we're not even talking about whether you should cast a black actor, which now most, I think, theater companies do as a rule. But this is considered so excessive that even the New York Times critic of the Times says, what is this? He's putting on a minstrel show. So if he is going to use this as an example of how to take a literary text and turn it into an opera, which is what he's a music professor, then I think he should have at least said, okay, now listen, some of this is going to be kind of shocking to a lot of people because the cultural potency of blackface, you know, is stronger now than it was, you know, obviously in Shakespeare's time, but even in the last century, to at least contextualize and just try to put that aside. I do think that if he had sort of warned students, not because it was going to trigger it, it's because it's going to be a complete distraction from the point that he wants to make. It would be like using the movie Birth of a Nation and say, okay, now I know it's racist and I know it looks like Ku Klux Klan are the heroes and blacks are nothing but lazy and sexual assaulters. Putting that aside, let's look at how the legislative process in this movie is determined. Well, there's so many other issues that you have to put to the side. Maybe that's not the best choice.
Right. Woodrow Wilson's famous, most favorite film showed it at the White House. So are we going all the way back to Jimmy Kimmel in blackface? Or are we going further back? But the point is, the kids that complained were saying it was very upsetting to us. Very upsetting. And he did not create a safe space. So this guy gets a
chance to spend some time in the ideological gulag that they developed there at University of Michigan. I think the kids are well served that are spending $75,000 a year out of state to come to that place and not to be taught by a teacher who almost won a Pulitzer Prize, who understands art and literature.
John.
Oh, he won.
Twice.
Oh,
he's a two-time Pulitzer winner. This is not
about
like
a horrible
legitimacy.
Person who should lose his job. Horrible.
But he's not losing his job. Don't overreact. Yeah.
What will happen?
Still, yeah.
Well, he carries the taint with him, will stay with him, so he gets a chance to come out from underneath that, because other people that were... professors are writing nasty letters about him. It's just absurd. It's an absurd world that these kids are living in.
Okay. In this particular case, John, I don't think it's as absurd as some other illustrations that we could maybe come up with. But like, for instance, James Earl Jones, he would be a great Othello. If you could show that version, it gets in the way of what he's trying to do. Most of his students will be music students, I'm assuming, since that's what his specialty is as composing. So I don't know that he'll be run out on a rail, which is what I think you're suggesting. But it could happen, I think.
Let's hope so.
That would be a shame.
Let's hope so.
I don't hope so. But he does. I think that he is culturally insensitive enough to not realize that this is something. If I was showing that, I would be myself sort of taken aback. In fact,
sure,
one of his defenders says because he's Chinese, maybe he wasn't aware of the cultural reverberations of something so exaggerated, which makes a lot of sense. If I was showing a movie from 1965 China, I'm not sure I would be aware of the cultural undertones or overtones of a work of Chinese art.
That would be the Red Guard, and that would be the students going around beating and killing and eating the hearts and genitalia of the teachers in China.
Well, I wouldn't be for that, John.
No. All right. Well, there we go. Another one bites the dust. I tried to look up whether that one guy that actually used Chinese words and then they said it sounded like the bad word. I tried to see if he's got a job back, but I can't find out. I think he's also on that same rail.
I believe he was vindicated, actually. The investigation showed that he wasn't.
Oh, did he get his job back?
Let's hear it.
All right. USC.
Woo!
400 teachers have lost their jobs since 2015. All right. Let's check in with Tracy Taylor. All right, here we go. You write to us at mynorthwest.com. You can text as well, 1-888-973-5476. 5476. Come on in through the state room text line. Let's see the remaining time. Let's see if we can do it. I'm going to make the decision. No! I'm going to say no. Well, the story's like 144 on this one. We'll get to it later. We will talk Seahawks, Tom, and I know you also, two big losses for you as well. The Huskies just
weekend.
Go down in a big ball of junk.
How can my two favorite teams both be 2-4? Oh, my God. Usually when the Huskies are terrible, the Seahawks can relieve me of my angst or vice versa. In this case, neither helps.
I was at a restaurant and the game was on, and I heard this one guy go, "Oh, we suck." To UCLA.
We're almost identical. We're down by two touchdowns in the first half. Then we come back, tie it up 17-17, and then we lose.
Yeah. What happens to a team like the Huskies? Is this a rebuilding year? Is that what they would say?
The dangerous thing right now is that we have a relatively new quarterback. He started last year, but he only played like four games because of the pandemic. So he's like a starting quarterback. It's a brand new coach. Again, or his first games or last. So right now, everything's up in question. You listen to post-Husky talk on the radio, it's all fire the coach, fire the offensive coordinator, change the quarterback. It's like, oh, my God, nobody knows what's happening right now.
You know, it's so strange. While I was watching, I was thinking, why is Tom so into Husky football? You went to the UW, right?
Yeah.
And
did
you go to the games when you were a student? Did you go?
Absolutely. Everything was the best deal. I was there for 7 years. The best deal was I got student tickets to sit. And that's when the student section was at the 50-yard line. So they're like great seats for really cheap. I grew up in Seattle. I grew up as a Husky football fan. I remember my dad taking me to Husky Stadium when I was a kid.
Because the Seahawks weren't around when you were a little kid. You didn't have professional football. Okay.
Exactly. So they were it.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, it kills me.
So when you were sitting there in the student section, were people looking at you like, hey, old man, what are you doing here in the student section?
No, because I'm not. I wasn't an old man. I was in grad school. I was 22. I was 23. I was 25. No, there are a lot of us there. I went down to the Rose Bowl game and watched us lose in a heartbreaking fashion to Michigan. Oh, it's, yeah.
I think 25, they'd be like, shouldn't you be sitting back there? All right.
I had a long, bushy beard, just like all my undergraduate fans. So,
were you drinking? Did they drink a lot? Passing around a thing of whiskey or something like that? Did they have a...
Yeah, you know, that happened, not with me, because I was one of the older, more responsible students, don't you know?
Of course, yes. I see. Okay. I thought prohibition was going on. All right, Tracy Taylor's got to look at traffic for us.